We are in Daniel chapter 5 tonight, if you'll open up your Bibles. Daniel chapter 5. This, of course, is the famous story of Belshazzar's feast and the handwriting on the wall. And we still use that phrase every now and then to communicate when the end is near, when it's clear that judgment is coming or some, you know, big moment of end is coming. The handwriting is on the wall. We say, well, that comes from this story here in Daniel chapter 5. Just quickly, the book of Daniel is about the fact that God rules. And it's clearly communicated. Daniel and his friends are living in exile in Babylon, far away from their homeland, probably far away from their family. And from a very young age, he and his friends were taken captive and groomed and brainwashed, really, to become Babylonians. But yet they were able to maintain their faith in God and draw lines in the sand where their values were. And they believed that God was in control of all things. And so Daniel and his friends are constantly reminded of God's rule, God's power. And the exiles as well are reminded of God's rule. So let's just read verses 1 through 4 here, Daniel chapter 5. Belshazzar the king held a great temple, which was in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God, which was in Jerusalem. And the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. They drank the wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. There's a lot I want to say in these four verses to kind of set the stage. First of all, I'm going to put up here a list of the Babylonian emperors, beginning with Nabopolassar, which was Nebuchadnezzar's father. The empire really began with him, but it wasn't until Nebuchadnezzar that the empire reached its zenith. And of course, that was the king that went to Jerusalem, raised it to the ground, burned the temple, and brought the captives back. Down to Nabonidus, that's the last documented king of the Neo-Babylonian empire. Now you ask the question, well, where is Belshazzar? Verse 1 mentions Belshazzar the king. Where is he? Well, he's not in this list because he doesn't appear until, he's not actually listed in a lot of the old and ancient records of the Babylonian kings. And so because of that, hundreds of years, critics of the Bible did not believe that Belshazzar was a real person. And so they believe that this was a made-up figure or maybe a mistake by Daniel. And so the Bible was viewed as inaccurate here. Until about 100 years ago, a little bit over 100 years ago, it was learned that Belshazzar actually was Nabonidus' son who co-reigned with his father. Nabonidus left the kingdom, exiled himself, went on a long journey for multiple of reasons, and a long time. Belshazzar was left in his place to rule. So the Bible was proved true. Now, I want to emphasize that point here at the beginning because this helps us deal with Bible difficulties. When there's a Bible difficulty that we don't understand, we don't have an answer to, don't assume that there isn't an answer. I'll say that again. Just because you don't have an answer to a difficulty in the Bible doesn't mean that there isn't one. It may just be that you haven't studied enough, maybe that we don't know enough about the ancient history behind the text. And the reason that I emphasize that at the beginning is because at the very end of the chapter, Darius the Mede is mentioned as receiving the kingdom at about the age of 62. We do not know who Darius the Mede was. Okay, there's no historical document outside of the Bible and the book of Daniel that mentions Darius the Mede. But that doesn't mean that he wasn't a real person. Critics and skeptics of the Bible will point a lot of times to the book of Daniel as an inaccurate, unhistorical book of the Bible. But we need to learn a lesson from this account here, that Belshazzar was believed to not be a real person, and then much later we found out that he was. The Bible was proved to be true and vindicated. So don't assume that there isn't an answer just because you don't have one. It could be that later on we find out who Darius the Mede is as we discover more things in archaeology. So let's talk about Belshazzar's feast here. We need to understand that this is not an innocent birthday party with balloons and cone hats and noisemakers. This is a very reckless drinking party. There's a lot of things wrong with this feast. One of the things that's wrong is what's going on in the city of Babylon and around the city of Babylon at this time. The text doesn't mention this, but Herodotus, which is a Greek historian much later, tells us what was going on at the time. He writes that Cyrus, the Persian king, marched forward against Babylon. The Babylonians, encamped without their walls, awaited his coming. A battle was fought at a short distance from the city, in which the Babylonians were defeated by the Persian king. They withdrew, and they shut themselves up and made light of his siege, having laid in a store of provisions for many years in preparations against this attack. For when they saw Cyrus conquering nation after nation, they were convinced that he would never stop and that their turn would come at last. And this sets the stage for Belshazzar's feast. The Persians are sieging the city. And so what they've done is they've withdrawn, they're in the city, and they think to themselves, there's no way that he's going to get in this city. Because we have two walls surrounding us, we have a store of provisions, we don't have to go outside. Cyrus eventually is going to give up. We're strong enough to overcome this. And this is going to play into the story later on. We're going to see that God brings the city down. God brings the king down. And so with this in mind, keep in mind what's happening here. Belshazzar knows what's going to happen. In fact, Nabonidus, his father, though he had exiled himself, he came back, but then he fled because he saw what was going to happen. This is not a time for feasting and drinking. This is a time to be fortifying yourself, especially fortifying your belief in God. But here he is, giving his last hurrah, maybe eating, drinking, being merry, knowing that his time has come, or maybe thinking there's no way that we're going to be overcome by this. He's trying to drown his fear or just giving it his last hurrah. Either way, it's a foolish move on his part. Notice what he does in verses 2 and 3. He calls for the vessels that were taken out of the temple of God in Jerusalem, those silver and gold cups and pitchers, bottles, that sort of thing. And he calls for them so that they can drink wine out of them. Now, this may seem strange, but what Belshazzar is doing is he's making a mockery of God. Imagine for a moment, and this is not a perfect parallel, but just imagine, hopefully just convey the idea here, that someone takes the plate that we use, the bread of the Lord's Supper, and the cups that we use that, and they pour some sort of liquor in the cups, and we pass it around. And we put some sort of, you know, awful thing in the plate where the bread is, and we use that to worship Satan, or we use that to worship another god. And that would just, it would not sit well with us, because those, they're not special emblems, or they're not special plates or anything, but you kind of get the idea. They're using something sacred for a purpose that they're not designed for. And here Belshazzar is doing just that. He's using these, and he's praising idols in verse 4. They drink the wine, they praise the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. This is not a time to be doing that. Mocking God, drinking it up, becoming drunk. Belshazzar is making a very foolish decision here. Other sources tell us that Belshazzar had brought in the idols from the outlying cities of Babylon, brought the idols into the city either to protect them from being stolen by the Persians, or to bring these idols in maybe as an extra layer of protection. Maybe the gods will be with us if all the idols are in the city. And so you see, they're praising these idols, praising the works of their hands, and they're mocking God. But it's God, ultimately, who is in control of all of this. God is going to judge the city and judge Belshazzar for what's happening here. Verses 5 and 6 tell us that there's a handwriting that appears on the wall. Suddenly, the fingers of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw the back of the hand that did the writing. Then the king's face grew pale, and his thoughts alarmed him, and his hip joints went slack, and his knees began knocking together. I want you to notice the detail that's found in this description. The fingers of a man's hand, the exact location on opposite the side of the lampstand on the plaster, and the king saw the back of it. It's almost like a movie. A very vivid description here so we can picture it for ourselves. You see this disembodied hand, and the king's response is just absolute terror. Verse 6, his face grew pale, his thoughts alarmed him, and his hip joints went slack. The Christian Standard Bible actually says he soiled himself. He's so afraid that he loses control of his bodily functions, and his knees begin knocking together. He is trembling with fear. And you can kind of see why, given the context here. The city is besieged, and they're just drunk. They're engorging themselves with wine and all kinds of alcohol. And he sees this supernatural event, and he's totally terrified. Maybe he thinks he's seeing something. But the point is that this festive feast turns into fearful chaos. There's just chaos. There's fear that interrupts this. This was certainly not on the plan, on the program for tonight. When I read this story, a lot of times I think about the character on the Addams Family thing, you know, the disembodied hand. And, you know, it's just a mental picture that we have, but this isn't meant to be a comical thing like the Addams Family, right? This is meant to get their attention. And certainly, if you had seen this, a disembodied hand writing, scraping in the plaster on the wall, that would certainly get your attention. And this is what God is doing here. So in verse 7, the king called aloud to bring in the conjurers, the Chaldeans, and the diviners. The king spoke and said to the wise men of Babylon, "Any man who can read this inscription and explain its interpretation to me shall be clothed with purple and have a necklace of gold around his neck and have authority as third ruler in the kingdom." And all the wise men came in, but they could not read the inscription or make known its interpretation to the king. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed. His face grew even paler, and his nobles were perplexed. So the Chaldeans cannot interpret the message here. Now, it's not a matter of the words not being understandable. These words we're going to see later on are actually words that are readable. But the question is, what do they mean? Just these random words scratched on the wall, what do they mean? They don't know. Does this sound familiar to us? This is the third time and the final time that the wisest men, the smartest, most intelligent men of Babylon are brought in, and they're presented as inept and incapable of reading the vision or interpreting what this means. And you see this in Daniel 2, you see it in chapter 4. And finally, once again, they're always presented as incompetent. They cannot read this because they're trusting in their own wisdom, trusting in their own education, rather than trusting in God. So verse 10, the queen entered the banquet hall because of the words of the king and his nobles. And the queen spoke and said, "O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts alarm you or your face be pale." Now, this queen is probably his mother. We know that Belshazzar's wives and his concubines are already there from verse 2. This is probably his mother, although it could be someone else. We don't really know that for sure. But she at least remembers Daniel. She's old enough to remember Daniel and what happened much earlier before Belshazzar. She says, "There is a man in your kingdom in whom is a spirit of the holy gods. And in the days of your father, illumination, insight, and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king," father here is probably being used in reference to ancestor, someone who came before your predecessor. "And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, appointed him chief of the magicians, conjurers, Chaldeans, and diviners. This was because an extraordinary spirit, knowledge and insight, interpretation of dreams, explanation of enigmas, and solving difficult problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Let Daniel now be summoned, and he will declare the interpretation." So you see what people were thinking of Daniel, people who remember Daniel. Still, they think he's just a wise man. He's got a spirit of the gods. Daniel has tried to give credit to the Lord. Remember when he's interpreted dreams and visions before? It's not in me. It's not because of my insight, my wisdom, but it's God. There is a God in heaven who interprets dreams. But still, they think it's Daniel and his wisdom. But she says, bring Daniel in. This has happened before when Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. Daniel was able to interpret. The same Daniel is still alive today. Bring him in and he can interpret. Now, we need to remember that Daniel, many years have passed since we last saw him in chapter 4. Daniel is an old man at this point. I did a little bit of math, and just suppose Daniel was 13 years old and Daniel 1 whenever he was taken captive. At this point, he would have been over 80 years old. So Daniel is an elderly man, and for this youngish king to bring him in, he wouldn't have given him a lot of respect, perhaps, especially because he is very arrogant, he's drunk, but he's afraid. He needs to have an answer to what this inscription really means. And so in verse 13, it says, Daniel was brought in before the king. The king spoke and said to Daniel, are you that Daniel who was one of the exiles from Judah who my father the king brought from Judah? And he says, I've heard about you that you can interpret dreams and do wise things. And the wise men that I brought in, they're not able to interpret this for me. And he repeats his offer in verse 16 that if you can interpret this message for me, I'm going to clothe you with purple and I'm going to make you third ruler of the kingdom. Now, I mentioned earlier that Belshazzar was not known of before about 100 years ago. And so this puzzled people. Why did Belshazzar offer the third ruler, the third place in the kingdom? But now we see, because Nabonidus was one, Belshazzar was two, and so he can only offer third place here. And so it makes sense, like a puzzle. Put the piece in, and it's perfected here. And in verse 17, then Daniel answered and said before the king, keep your gifts for yourself, or give your rewards to someone else. However, I will read the inscription to the king and make the interpretation known to him. Think about what Daniel's saying here. Daniel's saying, look, I don't need your gifts. I don't need your money. I don't need your power. I don't need a promotion. he's not being rude here, but he's saying, number one, all your money and all of your offers cannot buy a wise saying from the Lord. They can't buy an interpretation from the Lord. But secondly, he's saying, you know, look, your kingdom's not going to last anyway. He's basically telling Belshazzar, you know what? I wouldn't buy any green bananas if I were you. And later on, he's going to be promoted to third ruler in the kingdom, but that same night, the kingdom comes to an end. So it doesn't really mean anything to Daniel with this offer here. It doesn't faze him at all. But he does want to interpret the dream for him. Verse 18, O king, the God, the Most High God granted sovereignty, grandeur, glory, and majesty to Nebuchadnezzar, your father. Because of the grandeur which he bestowed on him, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language feared and trembled before him. Whomever he wished, he killed, and whomever he wished, he spared alive, and whomever he wished, he elevated, and whomever he wished, he humbled. But when his heart was lifted up, and his spirit became so proud that he behaved arrogantly, he was deposed from the royal throne, and his glory was taken away from him. He was also driven away from mankind, and his heart was made like that of beasts, and his dwelling place was like the wild donkeys. He was given grass to eat like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he recognized that the Most High God is ruler over the realm of mankind, and that he sets it over whomever he wishes. Daniel does not begin by interpreting the inscription, the message. He doesn't begin that way. Instead, he backs up to Nebuchadnezzar and goes back to chapter 4, and he says, this is what happened to Nebuchadnezzar because he became proud. He's really preaching to him to give him the background, to give him the reason why this inscription, this message from God has come. And he says in verse 22, yet you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all this. Belshazzar knew what had happened to Nebuchadnezzar that we've studied before. And he should have learned from it, but he did not. He says, you have exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your nobles, your wives and your concubines have been drinking wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see, hear, or understand. But the God in whose hand are your life breath and your ways, you have not glorified. In the situation here, you've made a mockery of God, and in your life you become arrogant, you become proud, and you have not acknowledged and glorified God. He did not learn the lesson that was intended to teach him from Nebuchadnezzar. As a result of this, he says, the hand was sent from him, and this inscription was written out. This hand was not sent by some satanic force, was not sent by Marduk or Bel or any of the other Babylonian gods. It was sent by the Most High God himself to give him this message. And he says, this is the inscription that was written out. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. And this is the interpretation of the message. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found deficient. Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and the Persians. Now, those are weird words to us, okay? But these were Aramaic words that would have easily been read. But again, the problem was not finding the dictionary definition to these words. Each of these words were weights of measure that they would have used back in those days. So, mene would have been a mina, which was a large amount of money, a large weight. Tekel would have referred to about a shekel, and upharsin or perez would have referred to a half a shekel. But if you just saw those words, if you saw quarter, nickel, penny on the wall, you know, what does that mean? I can read those words, but they don't mean anything to me. What's the message that's being conveyed by that? That's the situation that we see here. And so what Daniel is saying is these words have this meaning. The word mene, the verb, means numbered. God has numbered your days and going to bring your kingdom to an end. Your time is at hand. Tekel, the verb, means to weigh or to assess something. You have been assessed on the scales and you've been found lacking. You have not measured up to where God wants you to be. And the two words that are here, upharsin, perez, upharsin is the plural form of the word perez. So that answers the question of why the two different words. They're not really two different words, just plural and singular. It's like us saying mice and mouse. You know that they're both referring to the same thing. And he says that means divided. Your kingdom has been divided and has been given over to the Medes and the Persians. And there's one more interesting thing about this last word, perez. The Hebrew word for perez contains the same consonants as the word for Persia, we find in verse 28. So there's really a pun here. It is doing double duty. God is saying you're being divided and your kingdom is going to be given right to the people who are knocking at your doorstep. Your time is at hand. He's telling him, King, your nation and you yourself are going down because you have refused to listen and acknowledge God. Think about how frightful that would have been. I mean, just think for a minute that you have seen this vision on the wall, this disembodied hand, and you've received this message from God saying, basically, your time has come, and you're at your end. I mean, that'd be a very humbling message, but this is the message God gives to him. Verses 29 and 30 tell us that this was fulfilled that same night. It says, then Belshazzar gave orders and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a necklace of gold around his neck and issued a proclamation concerning him that he now had authority as the third ruler in the kingdom. And that same night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. So Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62. That same night. That's a very quick fulfillment. Many times when God prophesies something, especially in Daniel, it doesn't happen until hundreds of years later. But here, it happens that same exact night, Belshazzar meets his end. Obviously, this is not coincidence. This is providence working here. History tells us that this same night, in the fall of the year 539, the Persians entered the city, and they conquered Babylon without a fight. And this was not only the end of Belshazzar himself, the king, but it was the end of the Babylonian Empire as they would know it. It became, at that point, the Persian Empire. And if you add up the total amount of years that the Babylonian Empire lasted, it was less than 100 years. It was one of the greatest empires that has ever existed in recorded human history. But it lasted less than 100 years. Think about that. God brought this kingdom to a very swift end. Now, let's make a couple of applications tonight. Want to step back for just a couple of minutes and ask a question that has been on my mind a little bit as I've studied the book of Daniel. And maybe you've asked this question or wondered this question before. The book of Daniel tells us that God rules the world. Okay, Daniel chapter 2, verse 21, God removes kings and God establishes kings. If that is true, then why does he allow evil people like Belshazzar to come to power? This is one of the questions I think the exiles would have had to wrestle with. Why is God allowing us to be ruled by this ungodly and this idolatrous king, Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar, who don't acknowledge God at all? They worship their idols and they even mock God. Why does God allow things like that to happen? And it's also one of the questions I think we wrestle with. When we look at history, I mean, how do we make sense of people like Hitler? If God rules the world, why does God let someone like Hitler or Stalin come to power and just do awful, terrible things? How do we make sense of that? The book of Habakkuk actually deals directly with this problem. If you go to Habakkuk really quickly, Habakkuk takes place a little bit before the book of Daniel. Habakkuk looked at the people of Israel, and he said, look, God, these people are so wicked. The law is not respected. There's injustice. There's immorality. God, aren't you going to do something about that? And God says, yes, I am. I'm going to bring the Babylonians in, and they're going to bring judgment on this nation. And Habakkuk, that's not the answer he expected from God. Wait a minute, you're going to bring an idolatrous nation? A nation that is more wicked than us, and they're going to have victory over us? Habakkuk has this conversation with God, and he says to God in verse 13, your eyes are too pure to approve evil, and you can't look on wickedness with favor. So why do you look with favor on those who deal treacherously? Why are you silent when the wicked swallow up those more righteous than they? So even though the Israelites were a wicked people, the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, were a more wicked nation. And Habakkuk goes on to say, look, whenever they take us captive, they're just going to give the credit to their gods. They're going to bow down and they're going to worship the gods that they serve. They're going to give them the credit for all of that instead of acknowledging you, God. Why would you let this happen, God? And the basic answer that God gives Habakkuk is, look, just trust me. Okay, just trust me. And that's hard to do sometimes whenever we see evil things happening in nations and wicked rulers having power. But that's the answer we need to rest in, is just trust in God and his power. And the Bible tells us that God's sovereignty works through man's free will. That God is sovereign, that God is always in control, but at the same time, he gives people, like kings, free will. He allows them to choose the choices that they have. What that means is that God created us with latitude to make our own choices in life, but God can use those choices to fulfill and accomplish his overarching plans and greater schemes. We need to understand when we wrestle with this question that God does not cause man's wicked actions and choices. Just because God may have elevated Nebuchadnezzar to power or Belshazzar to power does not mean that God approved of or caused his choices. Think about Adam and Eve. Whose fault was it that they sinned in the garden? Was it God's because God put that tree there? Or was it Adam and Eve's because they chose that tree? God gives us free will. We just have to choose that. And so we shouldn't read evil kings' choices back on God as if God is an evil ruler and God is causing that. Again, consider the fact that God does not control every man's steps. God doesn't control every decision that kings make. Okay, he lets them choose. Think about the soldier or whoever it was that came in and assassinated King Belshazzar. Was he a puppet? Was God, you know, up in heaven controlling his every move. No, he was still a man with free will and choice. But yet he used that in order to accomplish God's purposes. And so when we come to a passage like Romans chapter 13, which deals with this question of authority and government and our submission to that, and we read how we're told every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. How do we make sense of that? That doesn't mean that God approves of every form of government and every governor or every king or tyrant or dictator there is. But what does it mean? It means that God has established government. He has established ways that society can function peacefully. God has instituted government as a way of promoting justice and bringing peace within the nations. And so regardless of how evil a king is, regardless of how evil a nation is, God is still in control and will ultimately vindicate himself and those who trust in him. And again, I want to point you to what God says to Habakkuk. God says, whatever happens, just trust me, okay? You may not understand why this evil king, this evil nation is coming in, but just trust me. Know that I'm in control. God says that the righteous will live by faith. That's what that means. The righteous will live by faith. The righteous choose to trust in God, even when we don't understand. You know, in our world today, we don't always see God in control. We know he is, right? But we don't always see that he's in control. And so sometimes we wonder, is God really seeing what's happening in this world today? We might ask, well, how is God using this evil nation? Or what is God's purpose in raising up an evil king or some evil force or some evil military over at some, you know, third world country? What's God's purpose in that? Well, we don't know. But we do know this, that God is in control regardless of that. Godless kings and godless nations will have their time of justice and their time of judgment, but the righteous will live by faith. As we close tonight, there's one more application I want to make that I think is a little bit more personal to us as individuals. As Belshazzar was feasting, the Persian army was surrounding the city and getting ready to go in, getting ready to defeat the city. And Herodotus once again tells us how they ended up entering the city. So what they did was, I mean, there was no way to breach the wall. The wall was just too big, too strong, too thick. But what they did was Cyrus dammed up a river that went under the wall and into the city. And he dammed it up upstream. And then when it was low enough, he let his army go underneath the wall. And they just basically opened the doors and took it from the inside out. Well, Herodotus describes how this happened. The Persians came upon them by surprise, and so they took the city. Owing to the vast size of the place, the inhabitants of the central parts, long after the outer portions of the town were taken, knew nothing of what had chanced. But as they were engaged in a festival, they continued dancing and reveling until they learnt about the capture. Such, then, were the circumstances of the first taking of Babylon. So interesting, this secular author actually mentions that they were feasting during the time of the capture here, just like the Bible tells us. But they weren't aware of that. They didn't know what was going on outside and even inside the city until it was right upon them and it was too late to do anything about it. I think there is a powerful lesson to take from that, don't you think? The lesson for us is that if we go through life living that same way, where we just, you know, live it up, we have no thought about God, no thought about our eternity, no thought about who we're serving really and what we're doing with our lives and where we're going to spend our lives after death, then we have nothing to expect but the same kind of judgment. Daniel tells Belshazzar in Daniel 5, verse 23, that you have not acknowledged the God in whose hand your life and your breath is. That's a powerful statement. Every single one of us, our lives are in God's hand right now. God has control over us. And he can take our lives or he can extend our lives. We need to acknowledge that and understand that God has power over us. And in the scripture reading tonight, Matthew chapter 24, relates to this point. Jesus says in verse 36, "But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. For the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah," or we might include the days of Belshazzar here. "For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away, so will the coming of the Son of Man be." If you and I are not ready, but if we're inside the palace, we're eating and drinking, we're just drowning our troubles, then the same thing is going to happen to us. God will number our days. God will weigh us and find us lacking, and God will bring us too into judgment. I want to end with what Moses writes in Psalm 90, verse 12. It says, "Teach us to number our days so that we may present to you a heart of wisdom." That's the attitude we need to go through life with sobriety, knowing that our days are numbered. Our days are short. Teach us to number our days so that our hearts will not be drowned in festivities, but be sober-minded, living our lives, putting on the armor of light, living for God every day. And that's the lesson for tonight. Live not like Belshazzar, but live like Daniel in light of eternity. If you're not a Christian tonight, I hope this last point especially has caused you to think about your relationship with God and where you stand before Him. If you know what you need to do, you know you need to believe in Jesus because you trust in Him, be willing to confess that faith, change your life, repent of your sins, and be immersed in water, and you're going to have forgiveness of sins right then and there. God promises that. God promises you salvation right now if you will just do what He says. If you're going to trust Him, live your life for Him. Why don't you do that right now? We're going to stand and sing this invitation song. And if you need to, make that known. Let's stand and sing.